Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. For many of us, the last 7 months have been a blur. It seems that time can be measured now by two eras, the before times and after the pandemic. But when exactly is the dividing line? For many of us, the pandemic did not become a salient issue until March, when known cases started going up, the NBA paused its season, and states began to lock down. But the first case of coronavirus disease was reported in Illinois on January 24th. Here's Dr. Allison Arwadi with the Chicago Department of Public Health during a news conference.
I will tell you some more about the patient in a minute, but I want to start by stating clearly that this is a single travel-associated case, not a local emergency. We obviously take emerging viruses very seriously, and there are still many unanswered questions about this novel virus. But I can reassure you that even with this Chicago case, the health risk to the general public from novel coronavirus remains low at this time, both nationally and in Chicago.
Even in early March, there was advice from public health officials, go about your lives. You don't need to take any special precautions now, but we might in the future. Well, we've come a long way since the first cases of coronavirus emerged in the U.S., and hindsight is 2020. But some recent studies indicate that the virus may have been circulating around the country earlier than we previously thought, and much earlier than the lockdown measures that were put in place. This is something that Jessica Davis, a PhD student in network science at Northeastern University in Boston, has been researching. She works with the, MOBS Lab, Modeling of Biological and Sociotechnical Systems, which is one of 44 organizations that inform the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's COVID-19 deaths forecast. She's here now to tell us more about their findings. Jessica, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'd also like to welcome back Rebecca Lee Smith. She's a professor of pathobiology and an epidemiologist at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Her research focuses on mathematical and statistical modeling of disease with an emphasis on control. She was also involved in helping to inform the university's reopening plans amid the coronavirus pandemic. Professor Smith, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for having me on again.
And listeners, we want to invite you to join the conversation. Do you have a question about the spread of coronavirus in the U.S., how we're tracking it? The phone lines are open. The number is 800-222-9455. Once again, 800-222-9455. You can also, of course, always tweet to us at 21st Show. Jessica, you've been modeling COVID-19 cases around the world at your lab. I wonder if you could explain for us in layman's terms what your model is measuring.
Yeah, so essentially we have this global epidemic and mobility model, which we call GLEAM. And you can kind of think of it as a computer program that creates this synthetic world. And in this world, we can model how people interact. So for instance, we can say that school kids are more likely to interact with other kids their same age when school is in session versus when it's not. But we can also incorporate information on mobility. So where do people fly to and from? How do people commute and all of that? And so using this framework, we can test out different scenarios. Like if there was a virus that began in Wuhan, China, how would it spread? What can we do to stop it and whatnot? So we can
Is the model sort of simulating data, or are you using like actual flights that left Wuhan on December 28th at 7 p.m., that sort of thing?
So our data isn't that rich, unfortunately. We wish it was. So we do take real-world flight data from different databases, and we incorporate that into our model. But it's not as precise as certain daily flights.
Yeah, sure. Well, so I think I've heard of this sort of described like the Sims computer game. Maybe that's not quite the right analogy, if anyone remembers playing that series of games where you could sort of model cities or families and sort of live out their lives and make decisions for them and there's a certain randomness in it. But I guess, were there any surprise findings as in your models?
Yeah, so one of the things that we did was to model, or was to try and understand this cryptic phase of the epidemic. So the time when no one was really, people were concerned about it, but no states really had the testing capacity to see whether or not COVID was spreading within their community. So using our model, we're able to generate kind of an estimate for the number of importations that different states received from China and other high-risk regions, and then kind of get an understanding of when was transmission of SARS-CoV-2 kind of established within each state. And so for a state like Illinois, it was established probably around mid-February. And so this was a lot earlier than many lockdown measures or even any like national news. And so what this tells us is that we are kind of late to the game with respect to things. So
yeah, with the measures that the government took to try and respond to this. So Professor Smith, I wonder, the first known documented case of COVID-19 in Illinois was late January. We heard that tape at the beginning of the segment about it was a travel case, somebody who had visited a relative in Wuhan. Would it be possible that there were cases here earlier that just went undetected?
It would be possible that there might be cases slightly earlier. I doubt that there were cases much earlier because we know that the virus emerged in late November, early December. So early January is about as soon as we would expect introduction to have occurred, because of course, when the first case emerges, it takes a little while for a number of infectious people to grow so that it could be exported to other countries. So it is possible that the virus was circulating in earlier January, but we don't have any proof of that at the moment because, of course, as Jessica said, the testing capacity was so low. And we know now that a large number of cases are only mildly symptomatic. And given that January is in the midst of cold and flu season, it's entirely possible that some of those mildly symptomatic cases would have gone undetected simply because people thought they had a bad cold or the flu.
You know, I'm curious about this idea of how a virus or a disease like this sort of takes root in a population. And Professor Smith, one analogy that's been used to describe COVID-19 taking root in the U.S. is like a fire, right? So it's possible you have these little embers of cases. Maybe some of them got snuffed out. Maybe some of the others blossomed into a larger fire. I mean, what do you think of that as an analogy? And do we know if, I mean, are these little fires, or was it more of like a, you know, sort of a flashover? How do these viruses and diseases take hold in a population?
That is a really good analogy for how this can take hold, that we see the embers. There were introductions from China. There were many introductions in the U.S. from Europe, where the virus took hold a little bit sooner. And yes, these little embers can drop in, and we have what we call a stochastic effect, meaning there's a lot of chance involved. Maybe one person doesn't transmit it, and so that ember is snuffed out, but once you get to a certain number of secondary cases, it can grow exponentially and it turns into a wildfire. So there's in the early stages a lot of chance involved. So maybe a case spreads, maybe it doesn't, but once it gets going, then it establishes itself and you will see higher number of cases, and it is much harder at that point to then control.
Yeah, maybe somebody goes to a choir practice, as one of the famous cases in Washington State, or maybe they stay home, and I guess that would make a big difference there. Jessica, I'm curious, so what your modeling says about how many cases were initially in Wuhan and how this might have spread. I've seen reporting in scientific literature that the first documented case was in, I think, the beginning of December. The South China Morning Post you know, quoted seeing some government documents that reportedly had cases in possibly going back to November. I wonder, Jessica, what your model says about, you know, how this really began and when it began overseas.
Yeah, so in our model, we kind of, we assume that the disease kind of started somewhere between mid-November and early December. Our model doesn't really tell us when. We kind of take that data from the pre-existing literature, I guess, that you are talking about. And what we find is our model results kind of align with what we're seeing now in the number of deaths and the number of cases. So we believe that that starting time is a good estimate for when the virus arrived.
Okay. And I should remind listeners, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Jessica Davis, who's a network scientist, a PhD student at the MOBS lab at Northeastern University in Boston, and Becky Smith, who's an epidemiologist and associate professor of pathobiology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. If you have questions about the early spread of COVID-19, we're talking about the possibility that it might have been in spreading in this country pretty well before we began taking sort of lockdown and social distancing measures to try and combat it. The phone lines are open. 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. Professor Smith, I wonder what sort of ways do we have of trying to research how early this, I mean, are there ways of looking back? I mean, you know, a virus has a genetic code. You know, are there old hospital samples around that can be tested? How can we continue this investigation?
Yes, and I'm sure that some of this work will be done for many years into the future. So one way that we have looked at it is that researchers have looked at the variability in the genetics of the virus that is currently circulating and that was circulating when we first understood how widespread the infection was. And that gives us an idea of how long since it was introduced from wherever it was introduced from. So that this is what gives us an idea, for instance, that we had many cases introduced from Europe rather than directly from China, because we're seeing many cases that are genetically similar to what was circulating in Europe at the time. But we can also use evolutionary models to get an estimate of how long the virus has been circulating outside of the population that it came from. So all of this can be done, but this is all a statistical analysis based on the sequence of the virus circulating here versus the sequence of the virus circulating in other places. One of the things that you mentioned that could be done and that will be of great interest is going back and looking through laboratory samples to see if we can find earlier cases. This is not always possible. Laboratories don't always keep those samples for a long period of time. It takes actually quite a bit of space and time to store samples, and for routine things like testing for the influenza, you wouldn't keep those samples around. So it will be a question of, are there any sample sets available to go back into? And I'm sure people are looking at that right now, but just going back to see if you can identify where there might have been virus prior to when it was first detected.
And are there limitations to that sort of genetic-based approach
when you're absolutely trying to... There are always limitations. So one of the limitations to the genetic-based approach is simply the bias of whose virus is being sequenced. So in order to have your virus included in the sequencing, you have to have had a sample taken that was then sequenced and then added to the information. And so that there's quite a few steps along the way. So there, not everybody gets their viral sequence added. So we may have a bias towards certain people who, for instance, get their medical care from academic medical centers rather than from more community-based practices. So there's a lot of biases involved there. And as I said, it's a statistical analysis. We can't prove that a particular pathway was the one that was taken. We can just say that it was the most likely of the ones we examined. So there's always potential that we could be wrong.
Interesting. All right, we need to take a quick break here. We are speaking with Becky Smith, who's an epidemiologist and a professor of pathobiology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and Jessica Davis, who's a network scientist in the MOBS lab at Northeastern University in Boston, about how early COVID-19 might have been spreading in the U.S. Certainly, it seems, before a lot of the social distancing and other public health guidelines were put into place in March. We do have a question from a caller on the line. Greg, hang on. We will get to you after a break. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. For 150 years, Busey has helped business owners and entrepreneurs navigate financial decisions, achieve long-term goals, and realize dreams of success. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about COVID-19 and the possibility, the likelihood, I guess we can say at this point, that it was spreading in the United States significantly earlier than many of us realized. That is, in March, when governments, state governments began putting in social distancing guidelines and ordering businesses to close down. We're speaking with Rebecca Lee Smith. She's a professor of pathobiology and an epidemiologist at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And we're also talking with Jessica Davis, a PhD student in the network science at Northeastern University in Boston. And she works in a modeling of biological or socio-technical systems lab, or MOBS lab, I will get that right, which is one of the groups that informs the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's COVID-19 death forecast. Listeners, you're welcome to join the conversation. The number is 800-222-9455. If you have questions about how early COVID-19 was spreading in the U.S., perhaps you are one of the... I tweeted about this a couple of weeks ago, and many people responded saying they thought they had COVID-19 or something similar to that. Obviously, many of testing was not widely available at that point, but people who said they thought they had it in February, possibly January, some even earlier than that. And there was a UCLA study that found there were about 1,000 more cough patients than average during a 13-week period between December 2019 and February 2020. The assumption is maybe those are COVID cases weeks before, as I said, the lockdown measures and social distancing were put in place. And I want to go to the phones now because we have Greg on the line from Woodstock. Greg, thanks for calling in.
Good morning. I just wanted to let you know that I think that I had COVID. I usually get the flu about once every 3 years, and I got it in December of 2019, and I got over it. And then in January, I got it again, and I thought, this is pretty unusual for me. I was in bed for 10 days. I couldn't eat, couldn't sleep. I was coughing and malaise. And I got over it, and then I went back into, I'm a radio show host at WHIW, I went back into the studio again, did a couple of shows with my co-host. Next thing I know, she's got the same thing. Did I have COVID?
Interesting. All right, Greg, thanks for the call. And I should say, I guess neither of our guests are physicians, so you're not going to be able to do a diagnosis. But Jessica, I wonder if, you know, Greg thinks he might have had COVID in January. Is that something that seems possible based on the modeling you've done?
I mean, I guess possibly. However, it is possible that, like, there are multiple flu strains spreading during the flu season. So it's possible that you actually got the flu twice. I'm not a doctor or a physician, so I can't really say anything.
Sure.
But we do know that, or we have found that it is likely that this was spreading possibly in January. Now in Illinois, I can't really speak to how early that is, but yeah.
Okay. And Professor Smith, I wonder if you have a perspective on that. You know, I mentioned that UCLA study that found 1,000 more patients with a cough per week starting in mid-December. I mean, go ahead.
So the UCLA study is interesting, certainly, but there are a number of issues with it that I would not put too much strength behind it. They were simply looking at cases with a cough, but they did not correct for the fact that it was actually quite a bad flu year in LA. And they also didn't consider the possibility that it was bad air pollution, or that what they were modeling was the percentage of cases coming into the hospital reporting a cough, which could increase if there were more coughs going around, but it could also increase if there were just fewer cases overall coming in and the same number of cough cases coming in. So there are a number of things with that study that I would not trust that was representative of an actual increase in COVID cases. The most important thing that I would note is that we know that excess mortality has increased shortly after the increase in hospitalizations for COVID-19, and that did not occur in December in California. So there was no increase in mortality in California in December, which is something that we would have expected. Their mortality numbers didn't go up until April. So I don't really believe that there was a huge circulation of COVID-19 in California in December, although it is an interesting study to look at and to think about, especially with the caller mentioned that he may have experienced influenza twice. I do know anecdotally there was an extremely bad cold that was circulating in November, December that was causing a lot of coughing. So I've heard from a lot of people, oh, I had it in November. Probably not, because it probably only emerged in November. But it is entirely possible that you were exposed to this extremely bad cold, which gave you a terrible cough. It is possible that you could get influenza twice in one year. It's not likely, but it is possible. And there is a chance of although I will say I am a veterinarian, not a physician, so you probably don't want me diagnosing you over the radio.
Fair disclosure. Thank you for that. So I guess, I mean, is it bottom line, is it fair to say once we have to kind of get into February, Jessica, in order for people to begin having maybe it be more plausible that they say, I had, you know, some of these symptoms, cough, malaise, maybe lost that sense of smell or taste, some of the hallmark COVID symptoms. I mean, mid-February, does that seem what most fits with your data, Jessica?
Yeah, I would say that it is more likely. However, what our model is kind of like it's a statistical analysis similar to what Professor Smith was talking about, of the possibility that the virus was established by that time. And we see that there is probably some local transmission happening by mid-February. But I would not feel comfortable saying anything definite.
Yeah, sure. Well, so I do want to go back, and it's sort of similar to the call we just had from Greg a few minutes ago. But back in April, we did a segment where we looked at what we called the promise and peril of coronavirus antibody testing in Illinois. And one of our guests was the Rock Island County Coroner, where the Quad Cities are located, Brian Gustafson. And this is what he had to say.
I personally became very, very ill in the very first part of January, to the point where I couldn't get out of bed for a week. I've never in my life been that sick. you know, looking back, as I look at some of the cases that I've worked up as far as individuals who have died, you know, November, maybe October.
So, Professor Smith, I wonder, I mean, at what point, as we're looking back, does this sort of verge into maybe, I don't know what the word is, speculative territory, perhaps, you know, far-fetched, conspiracy even? You know, is there a chance or any possibility that, because, I mean, you do encounter these people. You mentioned the cold is another possibility, a flu or possibility, but there are people who swear, yes, I had it in December, I had it in early January. How will we ever be able to sort of rule this out?
It will be extremely difficult to ever completely rule it out. Everything we have seen from the scientific community has shown that the virus really emerged in China, in the Wuhan area, around late November, early December. So certainly cases before then were not SARS-CoV-2. December, January, it's possible, but highly unlikely. And then moving into mid-January, early February, it becomes more and more likely. But again, as Jessica said, we can only refer to probabilities because in most cases, we don't have samples of their saliva or of their nasal swabs so that we can go back and check and see if the virus was present. So at this point, speculation is about all we can do. And looking at just the probabilities of where we know the virus was and what we know from genetic studies. And that all points to really an emergence in late November, early December, and that spread in the U.S. would have started mid-January to early February.
Okay, interesting. You know, you mentioned saliva in there, and that does remind me of the University of Illinois testing. It has been testing very widely using a saliva-based test. And because you're testing everyone, it seems a lot of people without symptoms are being tested anyway. Has that taught us more about how widespread asymptomatic cases of COVID-19 might be?
Yes, we have a lot of analysis still to do, but we know that especially among the college age population, a majority of our cases are asymptomatic or at least very mildly symptomatic. There are symptomatic cases. There are people who do end up spending a week or two in bed. Luckily, we've avoided any of the mortality on campus that we've seen elsewhere, but it is possible among the college age population. But we do see quite a few cases that would not normally be detected if we were just screening symptomatic individuals.
Interesting. I want to go back to the phone lines. Line one, we have Angie calling from Tazewell County with a question for Professor Smith. Angie, thanks for calling in. What's your question?
Well, part of my question was just answered. Thank you for taking my call. Seeing as how the White House rapid test didn't fully protect them, and I've recently had a family member who have had rapid tests that came up positive, then the nasal test came back negative. How accurate is the saliva test the University of Illinois is using? What is the expense of it? And are you able to produce enough that maybe our area high schools could start using them?
Okay, thank you for that question, Angie. Professor Smith, I was a little quiet. She was in a car, I think. But did you catch the question there? Was wondering about accuracy of the saliva-based test at the University of Illinois, and as well as how much it costs. And I think ultimately, can it be scaled out to K-12 schools in Illinois and other institutions?
And those are all extremely good questions. As far as accuracy, we measure accuracy in two numbers. Sensitivity is how many infected individuals can we detect? And specificity is, if an individual is not infected, will they become false positive? As far as specificity goes, we have extremely good specificity. We are likely to get a false. It can happen, but it is highly unlikely. sensitivity wise, we are still working on studies to show exactly what our sensitivity is, especially in the asymptomatic population. But in the lab, we know that we can detect very small quantities of virus. So we are very highly sensitive. As far as the cost, it's about $10 to $15 per test and scaling out to the rest of the state. The Shield Illinois program is working on that, and we are working as fast as we can to scale it out, but it absolutely can be scaled out much broader, and we are really working on that as fast as we can.
Okay, interesting. Let's continue with the calls. We have Tana on line 4 in Menard County. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. excuse me. I have a cough that is very similar to what I heard on NPR several months ago. It sounds like the COVID-19 cough that they were testing to see if that was a sign. So anyway, I have two basic questions. Could influenza A have been really a positive influenza A test in January, February been actually COVID-19? Secondly, what besides early oxygen, low oxygen levels, are other early signs before fever, sore throat, headache, blah, blah, blah?
Okay, thank you for the question. And I realize neither of our guests are physicians. Professor Smith, I wonder if you, I think if it's a positive flu test, that sort of rules out COVID-19, right?
A positive flu test rules in that it is influenza.
Sure.
We do not yet know about co-infection with influenza and COVID-19, but a positive influenza test would say that influenza is definitely present.
Sure.
As far as early symptoms, we're still working on that. There's a lot to learn still.
Yeah. I think I've, in addition to the mild cough, loss of smell seems to be one of the ones that scientists are exploring. I've even heard suggestions of, sort of having a smell test, basically, as being a way that people might be able to have a very early detection. But I don't want to get too speculative. I guess big picture, Jessica, I wonder, and we've only got about a minute left before we wrap this conversation, but why is it important to look back and try and understand when this was spreading here? When we're still looking forward and trying to keep ourselves safe and trying to find a light at the end of the tunnel here. But what is the importance of looking back and understanding how it spread?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I think looking back and kind of understanding how we got to the point of got to March and April and experienced the first big wave in many states, looking back and seeing how we could have done things differently will help us in this next wave, whatever number it is. And so getting an understanding of how it spread and what we can do to actually mitigate the spread is important.
Okay. Jessica Davis is a network scientist, a PhD student in the MOBS lab at Northeastern University in Boston. The lab works and advises the CDC's deaths forecast. It's one of the groups that informs the CDC's deaths forecast. We've also been speaking with Professor Rebecca Lee Smith, a professor of pathobiology and an epidemiologist at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. I want to thank you both so much. This has been an interesting and informative conversation. Thank you for sharing your time with us.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up after a short break, we're going to be talking to another epidemiologist about safely trick-or-treating. Can we do Halloween safely this fall? Stay on the line. We'll talk more after a short break.